This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. A new study has found that even by the most conservative estimates, we are in the midst of the planet's sixth mass extinction event, the only one caused by a single species, and yes, that's us, humans. This is far from the first study to reach this conclusion. In fact, the Center for Biological Diversity warns that between a third and half of all species on Earth could be on the path to extinction by the middle of this century. There are some rays of hope, though, and you're about to hear one such encouraging tale. Dr. Stephen Kress is among those who believe that along with our ability to drive species extinct, we humans hold the unique power and responsibility to bring species back from the brink. Kress is director of the Seabird Restoration Program and vice president for bird conservation of the National Audubon Society. Along with award-winning Boston Globe columnist Derek Jackson, he's written a new book called Project Puffin: The Improbable Quest to Bring a Beloved Seabird Back to Egg Rock. Stephen Kress, welcome to Living Lab.
Good morning. It's my pleasure to be here.
You have dedicated essentially your entire career, more than 40 years, to trying to restore puffin populations in Maine. Why?
Well, I learned that puffins were hunted on this coast along with most other seabirds in the 1800s to the point of local extirpation, which meant that they were gone from the area completely. On the Maine coast, there was only one pair of puffins left on a U.S. island by 1902. And when I came to Maine to start working at the Audubon camp on Hog Island, I learned that there was a puffin colony only 8 miles from our mid-coast Maine island, Hog Island, and that was called Eastern Egg Rock. And knowing that puffins used to breed there, I felt a great sense of loss because I'd seen them in Canada and I knew what we were missing.
Well, talk a little bit about what we are missing. These are some very strange-looking birds that I have to say, whenever I see a puffin, it makes me feel like I should be in the Galapagos, not in Maine. What kind of a bird is a puffin?
A puffin is a member of the auk family, which is a cold-water group of birds distantly related to gulls and terns. They are the northernmost counterpart of they're sort of the ecological counterpart of penguins, which live in the southern hemisphere. So they kind of look like them, and they sort of behave like them. That is that they're a diving bird. They use their wings underwater, almost like flippers, to chase little fish underwater. But no, they're a cold water bird that's very much at home in the north, and its beak is, yes, it's brightly colored, but has function.
What do they use that brightly colored, really large beak for?
Well, the beak serves several purposes. One is a badge of age and probably health. The age of a puffin doesn't get that big beak until it's about 2 years old. It has no color on the beak until it's about two. And then it gets bigger and bigger as the puffin gets older, gets more ornate with more ridges and grooves. And so it's a way of communicating to other puffins its age and probably its health, because a puffin that can grow a big beak like that is a survivor. And in the bird world, the females, we think, look at the males and pick the ones that look like they're the best mate choice, the best survivor. And the males probably look at the females with the same thought.
Are puffins considered migratory? I know they go out to sea for long periods of time. Where do they go?
There's a lot of mystery about the puffins at sea. Mystery starts when they leave as a six-week-old fledgling. They head off into the dark, paddling off into the night. The first trip is to get out of the reach of predatory gulls, I suspect. It might snatch them as they leave their nesting island. But after that, little is known for the next 2 to 3 years. No one really knows where Maine puffins go. Some are offshore because they're not seen within 50 to 100 miles, usually, of the mainland. We have tracked a couple of them with little devices called geolocators. That showed us that after the end of the breeding season, those two at least went north up into the Gulf of St. Lawrence and one as far as Labrador. And then they both headed down toward the warmer waters of Bermuda for the darkest days of winter.
Talk a little bit about why these birds were hunted. I mean, you said that they were hunted nearly to extirpation, I guess is the word you use, not extinction. It was really only in Maine, not in other parts of their range. Why were they so coveted right in Maine?
So puffins were hunted in Maine, yes, but they were also hunted in Labrador and in Newfoundland and in Iceland and Europe. They're hunted wherever they occur. And the reason for that is that they're edible. And hungry coastal people were very eager to have fresh meat after long winters. And so after eating a winter of dried salted cod, one might imagine that the return of the puffins was something they really looked forward to. And most of that hunting period on the Maine coast was done not, you know, for any purpose other than just subsistence. The people, local people, were hunting them to put food on the table.
How many birds used to live in Maine? Do we even know?
No, it's very difficult to know how many puffins lived here. We're fortunate to have any estimates at all. In the mid-1800s, the records only describe it as considerable numbers that used to breed on eastern Egg Rock. I realized when I first read that, I thought, oh, they could have done better. But after studying them for so many years, I realized how difficult it is to come up with accurate numbers. To confirm an active puffin nest, you have to see an adults go into a particular hole with fish and come out without the fish. And the early naturalists were doing good to visit these islands at all, let alone stay long enough to see the puffins come and go.
Now, many bird species were, in some cases, driven to extinction or severely depleted by hunting for women's hats in the late 1800s, early 1900s. Was the puffin a part of that at all?
As far as I know, puffins were not hunted for hats. They may have been pretty rare on the Maine coast in time for that. Their wings weren't particularly fancy. They had dark wings that didn't have the long plumes of the egrets. They were probably hunted more for meat, but the breast feathers, the downy feathers, were probably taken for stuffing pillows and mattresses.
Now, your restoration efforts began more than 40 years ago, really. What's the status of puffins in Maine today?
So today, puffins have recolonized five islands off the Maine coast. And the colony that existed when our project started on Matinicus Rock has continued to grow. There's probably over 300 pairs there. The two restored colonies that we have actively restored by translocating puffin chicks in cooperation with the Canadian Wildlife Service from Newfoundland to Maine on Eastern Egg Rock and on Seal Island National Wildlife Refuge. Those colonies have continued to grow, and in total, there are about 1,000 pairs now nesting on islands off the coast of Maine.
Congratulations, by the way. That's a fantastic feat.
Thank you.
Obviously, it's possible for puffins to still live in Maine, but why didn't they come back on their own after the kind of hunting that you were talking about was banned, made illegal sometime in the early 1900s? Why were there still so few puffins by the 1970s when you arrived?
Well, that was one of the big puzzles. I wasn't sure why they continued to thrive on Matinicus Rock. I knew that colony was already increasing. Gave me encouragement to try to restore these lost colonies. Later, I think I figured it out, and it was the fact that, first of all, young puffins come back to the island usually where they hatch, and their strongest attraction is to return to their, what we call, a natal colony, the hatching island. And in fact, that is the reason why I was able to move young puffins to Maine, and they came back to Maine rather than to Newfoundland. So there was no tradition left of puffins breeding on an island like Eastern Egg Rock. The culture of puffin breeding had ended when the last puffin was shot or trapped on that island. Likewise, at Seal Island National Wildlife and other sites along the main coast, the hunting was just so intense that once the birds were gone, there was none left with a memory of the place. But still, puffins do colonize naturally islands, and one would have thought that perhaps in that 100-year absence, some would have come back. There weren't many left, just a little colony on Matinicus Rock and a much larger colony on the U.S.-Canadian border called Machias Seal Island, where several thousand live. But the other reason why puffins didn't come back was that the islands had been taken up by large numbers of nesting herring and great blackback gulls. These gulls benefited from the same protective laws that the puffin benefited from. It's illegal to kill them, but they have the advantage of being fed at landfills and garbage dumps along the coast, especially in the early part of the 1900s. Landfills were set up, and they were open feeding boards for the gulls. Their population really increased rapidly, and they also benefited from fishing, ground fishing. Boats would put out fish offal as they would bring cod back to market and other bottom fish, and they also benefit from feeding on bait tossed out from lobster boats. So for all those reasons, gulls have the advantage. Puffins don't get any of those benefits, and the gulls are here year-round in the New England area. They start breeding much earlier than the more migratory puffins. And so by the time the puffins came back, these historic nesting islands were crowded with gulls.
With only a couple of nesting pairs in the whole state, by the 1970s, was there any human cultural memory of puffins as a main bird, or had they been largely forgotten about?
When I started working at the Audubon Camp on Hog Island in the late 1960s, puffins were already known. There were some gift shops still selling puffin T-shirts, but it certainly was not widely known. I think the interest in puffins has greatly increased, as has the number of puffins. I venture there's still many more T-shirts in Maine than there are real puffins.
You guys have a great T-shirt on your Project Puffin website for sale, a stud puffin. I mean, they've become part of the tourist ethos of Maine. People come to see puffins now. Do you find that at all ironic, or is that simply really gratifying?
It's very gratifying. The thought that a puffin watching tour boat would go to Eastern Egg Rock now every night from the beginning of the puffin breeding season till the end of the season, and several times during the day, with something like many thousands of people over the course of the summer on boats just to see the birds go into the same islands where people went out and shot them. It was only 100 years ago. So the change in values and appreciation, I think, is one of the most heartening things we can look to in conservation, that people are beginning to notice and really beginning to care about wildlife. I think they begin to value it, and because they value it, it becomes important in our culture. They have to be more than a symbol on a shirt. What this project shows is that bringing back a species is possible, that it's the responsible thing to do, and it's going to be increasingly important to do this for wildlife around the world.
That's Dr. Stephen Kress. He is the Seabird Restoration Director of the Seabird Restoration Program and Vice President for Bird Conservation of the National Audubon Society, also co-author of a new book, Project Puffin: The Improbable Quest to Bring a Beloved Seabird Back to Egg Rock. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk more about how he was able to bring puffins back to the islands of coastal Maine. We'd also like to hear from you. Ask your questions and share your puffin stories. Our toll-free phone number is 866-999-4626. You can also send email to livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more when Living Lab continues after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with Dr. Stephen Kress of the National Audubon Society and the Puffin Project, his 40-year effort to restore puffins to the islands of coastal Maine. He is now, along with Derek Jackson, longtime Globe columnist, author of the book Project Puffin, The Improbable Quest to Bring a Beloved Seabird Back to Egg Rock. Our toll-free phone number here at Living Lab is 866-999-4626. You can also send email to livinglabradio@capeandislands. Ask us your questions and share your own puffin stories. Stephen Kress, you were a teenager, essentially, when you first came to Maine and began to learn about the plight of the puffin, but you were by no means uninitiated in the world of birding. Some of your childhood mentors, going all the way back to elementary school, were some of the luminaries of the birding world and the Audubon Society. Talk a little bit about how you first became interested in conservation biology.
Well, I was fortunate as a kid to be able to go out and go birding. I didn't come from a family where bird watching was a thing that was known, but I was fortunate to live near a park system, the Columbus Metropolitan Park System, and was able to play in the forest, to go fishing. I did go fishing with my dad, which was great, but it was probably those early birding trips with people like Irving Kassoy, who was a friend of Roger Torrey Peterson and Ludlow Griscom, and luminaries from the New York City Bronx area. They were members of something called the Bronx County Bird Club, which is now, which is remarkable for the people that were in that went on to be great leaders of the bird watching and ornithology movement. So, those connections were very important to me, and a couple things I learned from that was that I think my passion for bird conservation goes back to when I was a child. I was permitted to sort of be outside and to play in nature and to play in the forest. I kept a little zoo of animals, and I spent as much time as I could outside. It was important, and I had a friend that I played with, too, and I think having friends that you enjoy nature with is key. Mac Alban was a friend of mine who continues on as a freshwater ecologist with that same park system. And meeting these mentors that gave me their time and took me out into places, because I lived in a suburban area where there wasn't very much nature to see right there, but they took me out into the countryside, and I soaked it all up, and I was listening, often the quiet kid in the back seat, but I was all ears for what I was experiencing.
When you got to Maine, to Hog Island, and started learning that there used to be puffins on Egg Rock and other of these small islands off the coast of Maine, and there were no longer, you, in your own words, became a little obsessed with the idea that maybe we could put puffins back. But that wasn't necessarily the way a lot of conservationists, even colleagues in the Audubon Society, were thinking. When you started to put this idea out there that you might be able to restore puffins and bring them back to these islands, what kind of response did you get?
Well, it was a novel idea. At that time, people thought about seabird conservation as perhaps posting islands, keeping people off of them during the nesting season. That was about all that was sort of on the radar, and the toolbook was hardly a book at all for seabird conservation. And in part because there was the general notion that many people believed, I think some still do, we need to let nature run its course, that somehow a new balance of nature will eventually emerge, and those species that are not adapted to living in that new balance, that's their tough luck. But I didn't see it that way. There were other people that were doing bird restoration. I was just starting my graduate career at Cornell University. I was impressed by the Peregrine Fund that was trying to bring back the peregrine falcon. It had been lost on the eastern United States because of the use of DDT. And bald eagles were declining. There were many species in big trouble in the early 70s, and there was a beginnings of restoration efforts for some of these other birds, but not for seabirds. There was no history of working with them in this way, and they had the obstacle, the big obstacle, was that they head off to sea, where you can't see the success of your work for years because they are, young ones are maturing at sea. So there was all those kinds of obstacles, and plus the fact that puffins, because they were not endangered technically, there were critics that said that why bother to try to bring back a species that is still abundant elsewhere in the world. There are still colonies of millions of puffins in Iceland. The fact that puffins had disappeared on the main coast to some was not very important. But I felt that if we could learn how to bring back puffins on the main coast, it would not only be good for puffins by expanding their range and reducing their risk. When species are concentrated in a few places, they are at greater risk. It would reduce the risk for puffins, but also the methods we would learn would someday be useful to other rare and endangered species.
You call in the title of the book this effort of puffin restoration an improbable quest. Did you really think from the outset that it would work? Were you confident?
From the outset, I really wanted it to work. I didn't know if it would work. I knew I was doing something that was different that no one had ever tried before. I didn't realize the whole idea of trying to bring back a seabird was new. It turns out that this was the first effort to reestablish a seabird colony to a place where people had wiped them out in the past. I didn't think about that. I was really focused just on bringing puffins back to eastern Egg Rock.
You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with Stephen Kress, one of the co-authors of Project Puffin, The Improbable Quest to Bring a Beloved Seabird Back to Egg Rock. If you have questions or comments, our toll-free phone number is 866-999-4626. You can also send email to livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. Mary is on the line from Wellfleet. Mary, what's on your mind?
Well, I'm so delighted to hear you doing this program. I heard Dr. Kress on Living on Earth a few weeks ago and was telling a friend about it in Maine last weekend, and she looked on her iPad and found New Harbor was only an hour away from her. So we went up there for a 5:30 puffin cruise and just had the most wonderful experience of cruising back and forth, watching puffins fly around and light on the rock and fish and carry the fish back onto the rock. It was just a totally wonderful experience. I highly recommend it. I think your work has been so interesting and so important. I always thought puffins were mythical creatures because there was a poem that my mother used to read to me when I was a little girl, and I never knew that puffins were real until that 20 years ago.
Well, Mary, thank you for your call. Stephen Kress, exactly as you were saying a little earlier, how important puffins have become and the need for them to be more than just a symbol or a mythical animal in Maine.
That's right. I mean, one of the important lessons here is that the puffin is unusually charismatic. That is, it is super popular. And most wildlife doesn't have that kind of appeal to such a broad population. It's fortunate that there is an ocean bird with that kind of popularity that's now accessible that people can see. It's important because it's a way to introduce people to ocean conservation. The threats that we had to overcome, the early hunting of puffins for food and feathers, actually pale compared to some of the new threats puffins face.
Such as?
Well, I think there's two things that come to mind. First of all, it's the warming of the oceans. The Gulf of Maine is especially vulnerable to warming because of its shallow depth and because of the turning of the tides and other reasons. The Gulf of Maine is warming, it's changing, and the puffins are able to tell us about exactly how that's affecting their world. And hopefully that will get more people interested in climate change. We're seeing baby puffins that are getting the wrong kinds of food now because as the water warms, some southern fish are moving up into the area that they can't even swallow. Those kinds of changes make climate change more visible, and it will affect everything in the Gulf of Maine, not just the puffins.
Stephen Crest, describe the landscape, if you can call it that, that folks are seeing when they go out on these puffin cruises, that when you're out on Hog Island and Egg Rock, Machias Seal, these are really quite barren and inhospitable islands, although they're barely even islands. It's almost like rocks that just are sitting out there in the middle of the ocean.
Yes, the Eastern Egg Rock is a treeless island. When you see it from a distance, it's hard to believe that there can be so much life packed onto it. But it's perfect for seabirds. The edges of it are made up of huge granite boulders that have been broken off and tossed up by past storms. The center of it is a thicket of raspberries and other plants that help provide shelter for eiders to nest in. Rock outcrops in the center of it are perfect places for terns to breed. So it's a terrific habitat for all the kinds of birds that require this predator-isolated habitat. And I emphasize that because it happens to be located just far enough that predators such as mink and otter, which are the two most aquatic predatory mammals on our coast, have a difficult time swimming that far out. It's also safe from fox and skunks and raccoons and other hungry mammals with a keen sense of smell that would wipe out puffins if they tried to nest closer to the mainland. So when you see this small little island, it looks just sort of uninhabitable. And you would think it would be uninhabitable, especially for people. But I've discovered that there's a young group of people, college-age students, who are so enthusiastic about wildlife. They're people much like I was when I was college-age, that are keen to live on these islands. We have 30 college-age students, interns we call them, living on these remote islands all along the Maine coast. Project Puffin operates 7 field stations, not just protecting puffins, but terns and great cormorants and other rare birds along this coast. And that's what these students do, and when the storms come along, they're out there. They go out in late May. They stay till the middle of August living in little tent camps. They're all heroes, these people that live on these islands. And they need to be there to keep the gulls from taking the islands back over, and the eagles as well these days. There's lots of eagles, and they would displace the puffins and terns, I'm sure, if we weren't there.
That's Stephen Kress, the founder of Project Puffin and now co-author of the book Project Puffin, The Improbable Quest to Bring a Beloved Seabird Back to Egg Rock. If you have questions or comments, our toll-free phone number is 866-999-4626. Pat is calling from Falmouth. Pat, what's on your mind?
Hi. I met Steve in 1979 at the Audubon Camp in Maine. He's one of my lifetime heroes, so I'm really excited you have him on today. He's instilled in me a lifelong love of puffins, and not just because they're cute, but because they're so well adapted to their environment. I'm just really amazed at these little critters. I've also had the opportunity to go to Iceland, to Heimaey Island, and to spend time there with the puffin colonies. All started because I met Steve in 1979. He just answered my question while I was waiting, which is climate change affecting the puffins? I've heard from somebody who had gone to Iceland to look at the puffin colonies that they are starting to really decline. I don't know if overfishing is also a problem or if change in fishing. So I guess that would be my question for Steve.
Well, Pat, thank you for your call. Our toll-free phone number, of course, is 866-999-4626. Stephen Kress, in addition to climate change, is overfishing an issue for puffins in terms of limiting their food supply?
Thank you for asking that question, Pat. The puffins require a certain kinds of fish, and many of these kinds of fish are in decline and fished very intensely. The most nutritious, best-sized a young puffin to swallow is a young Atlantic herring. It's the same fish that is intensely fished along the coast, used mostly for bait on our coast. And the needs of the puffins and other marine animals are not calculated into the quotas that are set for these fish. One of our goals is to try to determine just how much fish that the seabirds need. One of the projects that the interns on Egg Rock do, in addition to keeping off gulls and eagles, is to sit in the observation blinds on the island, these little boxes. You see them when you go around the island. They get into these blinds earliest light, and they're watching just a few puffin burrows at a time so they don't miss anything, and they keep track of every fish delivery that goes into those burrows. Last summer, we calculated just about how much fish. It was over 2,000 little fish that a puffin chick needs in order to grow and fledge successfully.
That's a lot of fish for a small bird.
It takes a lot of fish, each one doesn't add up to much, so takes many of them, and that about 2 pounds, a little over 2 pounds of little fish to raise a little puffin chick.
The work you're talking about now is largely almost maintenance work. Let's go back to the 1970s. You had this idea that you wanted to restore puffins, but you had to, as you say, pretty much invent a plan on your own. How did you go about doing that, and what did that plan end up being?
So to bring the puffins back, I relied on a couple of things. One was that the puffin chicks are fed by their parents whole foods that the parents bring to the burrows, deliver to the chicks. They don't cough up regurgitated food like many kinds of seabirds. That was a plus. The other was that they can live in underground burrows. I had to figure out how to create an underground burrow. And another feature of the puffin's life cycle that was helpful was that they head off to sea by themselves, not with the parents.
How is that helpful?
If accompanied by parents, we were going to be in trouble because there's no way we could offer that. So the puffin, in some ways, was ideally suited for the idea of translocation, which means you move the young puffin before it learns where home is. You be the surrogate parent for it, and then it heads off to sea by itself. And that's what we've seen ever since. The chicks leave at night, they head off to sea, and it took 8 years before they ever came back and bred on Egg Rock. And we had to develop other methods along the way, like putting out decoys, which we found to be very attractive. Decoys and mirrors that help to encourage the first ones to come back, and they help to attract other birds. So it became kind of a snowball effect until last summer we had 148 pairs, which was our all-time record number of breeding pairs on Egg Rock. The Seal Island Project similarly took 8 years of hand-rearing Newfoundland puffin chicks. Each of these islands, we moved about 1,000 puffin chicks to each island.
1,000?
1,000. We were rearing up to 200 of them at a time on Seal Island National Wildlife Refuge. And then they would head off to sea, and then we would wait. And again, at the Seal Island Project, it took 8 years to have the first breeding. That colony has grown even more rapidly than Egg Rock. It's over 500 pairs. It's the largest colony of puffins in Maine now.
I will admit that I'm not the most patient person, but that first 8 years had to be incredibly hard. Just the frustration and the anxiety of waiting for these birds to come back while facing critics who say, this isn't going to work and it's not worth it even if it does.
Well, there were rewards along the way. I mean, living on these islands is in itself a wonderful opportunity. You see nature like no one on the mainland ever sees it. But there were times when I would wonder, you know, after 4 years of seeing nothing at all. When we put the decoys up 4 years into the project, we started seeing puffins almost immediately. They would land and they would sit with the decoys, but too often they would fly away, and then weeks would go by, we'd see nothing at all. And so it was another 4 years before we saw that first puffin flying at Egg Rock with fish, and that was, of course, a big moment. And in the book, we talk about that. Derek and I talk about the significance of that, how all that waiting and patience, literally proving the naysayers wrong that this was going to work. We just had to see it through. I felt that if we gave up early, if we gave up prematurely, didn't see it through, then other people would not try this kind of work. And that was one of my goals all along, was that I wanted to prove this method was possible. And that's sort of why I called it an improbable quest, because it had not been done before. And my single focused view of this was to make this work, to see this through. If it was going to work, I wanted to be there to see that first puffin come back. And fortunately, I did.
That's Stephen Kress of the National Audubon Society and Project Puffin, also along with Globe columnist Derek Jackson, now co-author of the book Project Puffin, The Improbable Quest to Bring a Beloved Seabird Back to Egg Rock. We'll talk more when Living Lab continues after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with Stephen Kress, director of the Seabird Restoration Program and vice president for bird conservation of the National Audubon Society. He's founder of Project Puffin and now co-author of the book Project Puffin, The Improbable Quest to Bring a Beloved Seabird Back to Egg Rock. Stephen Kress, after 40 years of efforts, there are now puffins nesting on five different islands in Maine. Clearly, Project Puffin has been successful, but would you say that it's complete?
So when I started Project Puffin, I just assumed there would be some logical endpoint. And I went to great lengths to try to find that. We brought terns back to the island, for example, thinking that the terns might be like a protective umbrella to chase away the gulls and eagles and other predators, because they live together in other islands. But I've since realized that they don't get back in time for migration, and the big gulls, which still are super abundant in Maine, and now the eagles, they are here year-round. I don't see an end point to this project on this highly developed coastline. People think of sustainability as sort of a goal for programs like this. I think we need to begin to think that people are part of the balance of nature, and it's up to us to decide which species are going to live into the future and make the necessary commitments to make that happen. In this case, that commitment is going to be keeping stewards, these young college-age biologists, on the islands into the future. And I think that we can succeed. It's not over. There's no end point that I see. In fact, I see new threats emerging that require even more innovation and creation. It's more than maintenance, really. It's a matter of figuring out how to solve new problems. For example, invasive plants. There's a number of them on the island that are overrunning the place, and we need to figure out how to manage that. And we need to be able to continue learning from the seabirds about climate change and about the amount of fish in the oceans that are necessary to support their populations. There are many lessons yet to learn here.
One in eight bird species is on the international red list, the endangered species list. It's one of the highest proportions for any type of animal. Why are birds so vulnerable?
And among the birds, the seabirds are the most vulnerable group of all. Nearly a third of them are globally threatened with extinction, not just local extirpation like the puffin was, but to extinction. So I think the reason that seabirds and birds in general are vulnerable is that they are, especially there's many local populations, especially on islands, that are threatened because of introductions of mammals to these otherwise mammal-free habitats. That's one of the issues. But the continents themselves are becoming increasingly dangerous for birds, especially the migratory species. If you just look at the housing density in the United States, the human population growth, the changes in habitats, and what we're doing to the habitat, the sterilization of suburbia with vast lawns soaked with chemicals, towers. The biggest problems facing birds in our backyards are two things that are actually fairly manageable, and that is collisions with glass. About a billion birds collide with glass every year and die in the United States.
Is that an excuse for me to leave my windows dirty?
Yes. Make them, soak them up. But there's lots of tricks that you can do to keep those backyard collisions from happening. And there's the other issue is outdoor cats. Probably even more birds die from outdoor cats, both feral and pet cats outside, than windows. And combined, the two of them are super lethal. So, yes, birds are suffering, mostly from habitat loss around the world and the high diverse areas. But even in our own backyards, there's things we can do.
Are there lessons that you have learned over the years from Project Puffin and your other seabird restoration work that you think could be applied more broadly to many of these species that are facing global extinction?
Well, one of the lessons is that I think that waiting for the balance of nature to bring things into some sort of a balance is a recipe for extinction. We really have to think of ourselves as global stewards, that if we don't take action, that in fact is making conscious decisions that we'll lose species. It's hard to know exactly what to do in some cases because we have to, again, invent the way forward. But that's what I did, and I think that other people who want to be helping on the side of life, they need to be active stewards. That's the big challenge. That's what I tell the students that work for me. There's every species needs a champion, and I hope that each of you will pick one that you will help survive.
I wonder what your opinion is of efforts that we've seen in recent years to try to bring animals back who actually have gone extinct, to use genetic techniques to recreate extinct animals and reintroduce those.
There are probably opportunities for that. I think that we're a long way from doing that, and it could be problematic. I think we have to carefully pick the species that are likely to succeed. But species that disappeared relatively recently might be some of the best targets.
Dr. Stephen Kress is director of the Seabird Restoration Program and vice president for bird conservation of the National Audubon Society. He's the founder of Project Puffin and now, along with award-winning Globe columnist Derek Jackson, co-author of the book Project Puffin, The Improbable Quest to Bring a Beloved Seabird Back to Egg Rock. Stephen Kress, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Over the years, Steve Kress has been aided by a small army of young, enthusiastic puffineers, as you heard him mention. Well, at the University of Washington, conservation-minded students are taking a slightly different approach. They're participating in the Campus Conservation Nationals. The idea behind the competition is simple. Researchers are experimenting with game-like techniques to engage people in achieving real-world goals. It's called gamification, and it's being used to teach college students to live more sustainably. Dennis Dubois reports.
All right, 3, 2, 1.
This party could be the start of a fierce rivalry here at the University of Washington. At least, that's the plan.
My name is Maria Sawhill, and I'm the resident director for Alder Hall. So tonight we're doing kind of like a kickoff event for the Campus Conservation National. So if we win as a hall, then I'll buy them a foosball table. We also have a little photo booth where they can hashtag how they're going to conserve energy for this month, and then they get entered into a competition to win $50.
The Campus Conservation Nationals are part of a trend toward the gamification of everything. Tech companies are using games to come up with new ideas. Drug companies are using games to get patients to take their medications every day. This game involves 140 campuses around the country who are competing to see which one can save the most energy and water. But in this dorm, it's less about beating other schools and all about what these residents can do to beat their rivals in the two dorms across the street.
I'm Casey, and I'm from Walla Walla, Washington. I don't really like showering particularly anyway, so I figured, you know, if it's for a good cause, why not just stop? I just figured that's the way I could do my part, you know?
Catherine, and I'm from Seattle.
the things I could do. I could unplug my chargers when I'm not charging my stuff, because that's a bad habit I have. And I've heard that's called an energy vampire, because it's sucking up energy without actually doing anything.
You know, here we are. Students are in university. They're trying to get their degree. They're learning. They're becoming adults. And our mission is complementary of the university's mission as an educator outside the classroom.
Clive Pursehouse is an administrator for residential life at the University of Washington. And for him, this game is about learning.
Universities are going to probably come up with the next great discovery that allows us to live more sustainably, and whether it's in a laboratory or in a classroom or in an office someplace. But we're really looking at how do people live. And part of the reason that we have these challenges environmentally and otherwise is because of how we all live, you know, just things that we do day to day. And so we really have an opportunity to make an impact on how students think about the things that they do and the way they live day to day. And so I think for us, really, the Campus Conservation Nationals is a kind of intense time for us to talk to people about energy use and conservation and those kinds of things. And so this year we're actually going to do it with Poplar, Alder Hall, and Elm Hall. So we have three buildings. They're all across the street from each other. And what we'll do is we'll do some things to kind of stoke competitive fire. One of the things I've heard on other campuses, and we didn't experience this here, is if students find out when the base collection time point is, they use more energy, you know, which is a shame.
Sandbaggers.
Yeah, they're definitely sandbagging it.
They hack it. They do all the stuff they need to do to win.
Susan Mazur-Stoman is a cultural anthropologist and the director of Behavior and Human Dimensions at the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy.
They go out to eat. They don't take showers. They actually do assertive, aggressive moves, and they will go and shower in each other's dorms. So they're brilliant at that. So I'm not saying that a game isn't a fun way to catch people's attention, but I don't think we're going to see long-term persistence. So if I were a game designer, I would make it harder. I would plug up some of those hacks that people could do, and I would really challenge people, you know? And I think people would rise to that occasion. I think we oftentimes underestimate that the challenge is what engages people and not necessarily winning.
There. See, it's not about winning. It's about the challenge, the teamwork, bonding together for a common cause. So, no rivalry, right?
Since there's a foosball table on the line, there's definitely a rivalry, because who doesn't want a foosball table? I mean, come on.
Dennis Dubois brought us that story, which he reported last year. He blogs at energypriorities.com. You can find out more about Campus Conservation Nationals, Project Puffin, and other opportunities for young conservationists on our website, capeandislands.org. Until next week, this is Living Lab. You can always find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Major support for Living Lab is provided by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment and the Candida Fund. Additional support is provided by Lee McGraw and the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. Living Lab is produced by Heather Goldstone. The executive producer is Mindy Todd.